North Korea, Iran, the Middle East, the classroom, the dining room, the cubicle. These are the great diplomatic arenas of our time. I'm Jeff Horowitz, and you're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. We are, as usual, coming to you from the UBS Forum in downtown St. Paul. You know, we've been thinking for a while about a show on diplomacy, and with North Korea agreeing to six-party talks, now the possibility of engaging Iran to talk about Iraq, and, of course, that, you know, little nuclear program they have going on there, well, this seemed like a pretty good time to do that. But, you know, when we got a group of listeners together a few weeks back to talk about the show, a lot of their ideas about diplomacy did not involve high-level talks or the fate of nations. They made it pretty clear diplomacy is a concept that threads its way all the way down from those lofty levels to daily life. Diplomacy, high or low, is about relationships, and that cuts to the heart of what it means to be human. Fittingly, we're calling tonight's program, Diplomacy Begins at Home. Now, for our first highly literal example of where diplomacy really does begin at home, look no further than Diplomacy, the board game. Now, outside a diehard following, the game is pretty obscure. Turns out, just not that many people are into diplomacy. Go figure. Most people would much rather play a war game like Risk. And the board for diplomacy looks a lot like Risk, usually a map of Europe or some other part of the world. But that's pretty much where the similarities end.
Diplomacy is entirely a social game. It's about creating an alliance with other people to become numerically superior.
Ryan Brace tried to get a diplomacy club together in Minnesota a couple years back, unsuccessfully. One turn off is that, well, diplomacy takes a lot of time and patience. Games often take more than 6 hours.
Between every turn, you spend 15 minutes talking in separate rooms, out in the hallway, whatever, agreeing who's going to help who. So I might suggest that this person is a jerk and he ran over your flowers on the way in. We should work together against him. If you buy me a drink at the bar, I'm more likely to help you into Norway.
Now, over 15 years, Ryan has played diplomacy with lots of people, and he has noticed that lawyers tend to dominate the game. And he has a theory about that.
One has to suspect they have practice at lying.
So lying is a fundamental aspect of diplomacy.
It is, and that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And I have found that Minnesota, of all the places I lived, is the hardest place to find diplomacy players. They're just not comfortable lying here. It's very frustrating.
Now, while the parallels between the board game and the real world have their limits, sometimes the game actually does hit pretty close to home.
Almost anything said to the entire group is going to be a lie. You then go off with the people in private and tell them what you really meant. And one suspects one sees that on the floor of the UN, where the actual discourse about what they're going to do seems entirely grandstanding. And then in the back rooms, they make the real agreements.
Interestingly, the game diplomacy is not about establishing harmony and having everybody sort of get along
Indeed
and find
not.
Balance in the world.
Indeed not. The game is won by either one player who has conquered half of the world or a coalition of players who are the only ones left on the board.
And that, I think, is an important point, not just for the board game, but for the rest of our show tonight. Diplomacy is not the conventional concept of being diplomatic, letting people down easy or getting along just to get along. Diplomacy, from the international to the personal, is about accomplishing goals. It is still about prevailing. Keep that in mind. We've got lots more in store for you over the next hour. The Smarts are back with us as our house band for the evening. Whether you're with us on the radio, your computer, your MP3 player, or here at Minnesota Public Radio, thank you for joining us in the loop. Now, a few moments ago, I mentioned that we had a little gathering of people to get together and talk about this upcoming show. Before we move into this show, I'll mention that we've got another one of those coming up. And the date, put this on your calendar, Tuesday, November 28th. This is going to be at the Bad Waitress Coffee Shop in Minneapolis. It's a lovely place, let me tell you. Don't let the name put you off. Check our website for details on that and a whole bunch of other things if you want to learn more about us. We're at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. You know, since we're talking tonight about diplomacy in all areas of life, we thought we'd begin the show with someone who has made a life of diplomacy. Tom Hansen is here to help us explore some major diplomatic trends and go beyond the normal coverage of events. Tom, thank you for being here.
Jeff, thanks for inviting me.
A little bit about Tom Hansen. He's spent 21 years in the U.S. diplomatic corps in places including East Germany, France, Norway, and Russia. He helped establish embassies in a number of former Soviet republics and spent 2 years working with foreign affairs committees in the U.S. Congress. And he's now back home in Minnesota working in a number of ways to help ordinary citizens better understand the world of diplomacy. So my first question for you, Tom, basically with that experience, how do we fix the world?
How do we fix the world? Well,
I'll save that one for the end. I'm sorry.
Well,
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
That's actually a good question. That's actually a very good question because as Americans, we often feel that we can fix the world.
Well, I think that'll get us into where I think I realistically want to go with the first part of this interview. And I think part of the reason that we're doing this show is there's a kind of a conventional wisdom out there, I think, that diplomacy, you know, the idea of working things out peacefully is losing favor. Do you think that's true?
You could argue that in the past 4 or 5 years it has. In many ways, the consensus that we had on foreign affairs has pretty much broken down, and we're a fairly divided country. I recall I was in Russia in the Soviet Union in the last days of that empire, and I recall being at a dinner in Moscow and sitting next to a Soviet general, an older fellow. He was festooned with medals. He'd been at the Battle of Kursk, which is the greatest tank battle in history, and as the evening progressed and we had more vodka, he eventually draped his arm over me and said, "Thomas," he said, "we are about to do to your country the worst thing that one country can do to another. We're going to deprive you of a threat." And in a way, he's very right, because we were very unified. It was such a clear situation during the Cold War. White hat, black hat, good, evil. Today, it's many shades of gray. And so I think right now there are two ways of thinking that are competing with each other. One of them is based on two factors. One, how darn powerful we are. It's almost unprecedented. Our defense budget next year will be $530 billion. That's more than the rest of the world combined will spend. And there are many people who think, well, let's use that power in a moral way, in other words, to actively promote our system and our way of life. And I think there's another school, which is probably the more traditional one, a kind of a realist school, which says we have to negotiate, we have to keep forming alliances, we can't do it alone. And it may be that after this election now, that second school may be coming up again.
Now, to sort of continue that thread, we have a clip of tape that might sort of help frame things and continue this discussion. If you can go ahead and play that for us.
America is a nation with a mission, and that mission comes from our most basic beliefs. This great republic will lead the cause of freedom.
Now, Tom, when I had asked you, when we chatted earlier, if you could point us in the direction of a pivotal moment in a recent change in U.S. diplomacy, you pointed me toward President Bush's 2004 State of the Union address,
yes,
which is where we pulled that clip from. What is the deeper principle that is behind the statement there?
It's something that's being called nowadays transformational diplomacy. The essence of this, and I think President Bush believes this very deeply, I think Condoleezza Rice as well, that to be human is to have freedom and the impulse for freedom implanted in your very heart and soul. That must be liberated around the world, that to get at the roots of terrorism, to have peace, you have to promote this basic human quality. And to sacrifice that for stability, you are acting in the wrong way. And President Bush announced before the United Nations that the United States reserves the right to intervene around the world in the name of this concept of human freedom.
I was going to say, haven't we always wanted to encourage freedom,
right? Absolutely.
What, is this a really crucial difference?
Well, you know, it's a deep tradition here in our country that it's associated with Woodrow Wilson, the idea that American foreign policy should always be based on principle and should be the implementation of the principles we stand for, as opposed to just realpolitik and stability. So there are deep roots to this. But I think our transformational idea right now is becoming more, shall we say, operational, less of a theory. I think what's happening at the State Department right now kind of shows that to some extent. Condoleezza Rice earlier this year announced a new transformational diplomacy initiative. It's called Global Repositioning. So the idea being that there are many cities and countries around the world that need transforming where we do not have any diplomatic representation at all. And therefore, we should totally realign our resources for this transformational goal. So our embassies in Europe, our large embassies in the developed world are being cut back immediately. And we're going to be sending out small teams, joint State Department, DOD teams, to basically represent the United States far out in unstable parts of the world.
I want to talk about some of the big issues, you know, yes, in the news as we speak. Of course, North Korea generally agreeing to some talks, but exactly when and how is still to be determined. And then this thing called the Baker-Hamilton Report, which is a congressionally, you know, mandated panel of people, yes, who look like they're going to say we should engage with Iran in order to address the issues in Iraq. I mean, it seems like the major diplomatic question of the day is, do we engage with bad people, or do we find other ways to address them?
And that is one of the issues where, as I say, this kind of divided state we are in right now as a country, where you see this. You know, a lot of Americans do see the world in terms of good and evil. I think for a lot of people who don't want to have contact with a regime like Iran, they'll cite the example of the Munich Agreement with Chamberlain and Hitler in the late 1930s as an example of how if you do business with an evil government, look at the result. Or when Madeleine Albright went to North Korea and found herself in a huge stadium at a festival praising the North Korean leadership. On the other hand, though, diplomacy is communication among strangers. That's the definition of diplomacy, and you have to have communication. And I think it's very interesting that James Baker, of all people, is heading this new study group, because if you read his memoirs, he goes on about the importance of negotiation, of finding initial small points of common ground and building upon them. And he really emphasizes his personal relationship with Edward Shevardnadze at the end of the Soviet Union. I mean, if ever there was a regime change, it was the end of the USSR. And I think Baker would see the fact that we had contact, so much contact with Gorbachev in the last years that might have facilitated that change. So that Iraq study group has a totally different concept from what this administration has followed so far. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out.
Now, in our opening piece, we had a little fun with the notion that that lying or deception was a crucial aspect of at least the board game called diplomacy. Can we apply that to the real world of diplomacy as well?
Yeah, to some extent, yes, just as you can anywhere in life, unfortunately. I'll say this, though, the essence of diplomacy is really the opposite. I remember George Kennan's definition of diplomacy. He was one of the great diplomats of the 20th century, was the importance of passing accurate information from government to government. I mean, each side has to know what the other one is thinking, what their goals are in order to have to build their policy. Now, on a larger level, toward China now, our military thinks that China is hiding its true military buildup, that its statistics are not real. In other words, there's deception. And a lot of countries, especially in the Middle East, see our transformational diplomacy as also a deception, hiding, whether it's a grab for oil or bases in the Middle East. In other words, oftentimes the real deception comes at the larger level, or at least the perception of that.
Well, you know, Tom, before I let you go, I mean, we're coming up on maybe, which I might say is the most diplomatic holiday of the year, possibly, Thanksgiving. I wonder, as somebody with all that experience in the Foreign Service, do you fare especially well when the whole family comes together?
I suppose diplomacy can be applied in one's private life in a lot of different ways. I mean, I think it was Friedrich Nietzsche who called marriage one long conversation. And in a way, it's also any human relationship is one long negotiation. One thing I learned very much in the Foreign Service, as somebody pointed out regarding the game diplomacy, is you really need patience. You know, a lot of Americans really want instant results, short-term thinking, and sometimes in relationships, too, in family matters, and that's where maybe at Thanksgiving, that's a good time to feel that kind of patience for people. On the more specific areas, I suppose, you know, you can always impose economic sanctions on a son or daughter who does something wrong. You can
Family summits.
Sure. People are always forming alliances, unfortunately, during divorces. You often see this happening. Diplomacy is a very human thing. It's human nature writ large.
Well, Tom, you've done an excellent job there sending us off into the rest of our show. Thank you very much
for
being
Jeff.
Here. Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Tom. Tom Hansen is retired from the Foreign Service after a long and distinguished career. No less distinguished, I hope, after spending some time with us here at In the Loop. You are listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. You might define diplomacy at any level as the art of getting what you want with a smile instead of a fist. With that in mind, we went looking for people outside the world of high diplomacy, whom you might nonetheless consider among the critical diplomats of our society. We're going to bring you some of those voices as the show goes on. The first of these is Carrie Wilson-Smith. She teaches at a Twin Cities school devoted exclusively to students whose behavior and emotional problems have made them unable to function in the regular system.
First of all, diplomacy here, you can't talk down and you can't talk above. Just like when you're dealing with another country, depending on what country you're dealing with, I think you have to determine what their cultural values or their needs are. Same thing with the students.
What? True or false, you should send a picture with your resume.
Not unless you're like applying for like a stripper or something.
Yeah, that's a good answer. You can left the part out about the stripper.
Well,
you are into control. This is not the place to work. Constant power struggle. It's not effective. I've seen people come in the building before, maybe a substitute or something, just battle with students. The student is thriving on that power. Really, you have to be willing as a teacher to not want and need that power.
No, snooze you lose.
Snooze you lose, okay.
I think if the UN had a tour of our building and saw how we were working together, maybe they would all start saying, well, you know, if you can come together for kids, then why can't we come together for a whole nation, a whole world?
That's Carrie Wilson-Smith from Dakota Ridge School in Apple Valley. Now, she faces a special mission, but anyone with kids can relate to the diplomatic challenges they bring and the lessons they can teach about diplomacy. For a firsthand look, we invited a mother of three to give In the Loop a glimpse into her own world of diplomatic codes and high-level negotiations. Please welcome, if you would, Nancy Olesen.
It wasn't so long ago that I was caring for two toddlers. One was mine, the other was a friend's. We were spending a winter afternoon together, cooped up in the house. I remember I was listening to a discussion about the Middle East on the radio, wondering why the Israelis and Palestinians cannot just get along. Then my son started to scream, "Give me back truck! My truck! Give me truck!" I was again in the impossible situation of attempting to broker a truce between two warring toddlers. No wonder world diplomacy is so hard. From the moment we start playing with others, we humans are struggling for the upper hand. My children are now 11, 13, and 16, which makes me a domestic diplomat starting each day at dawn, getting my son to make his lunch, moderating a dispute over whose iPod gets plugged into the stereo, figuring out who's supposed to be walking the new dog. I do have a partner in this work of diplomacy. My husband and I try to present a united front to the kids. We have our own diplomatic code, facial expressions that denote things like, "Let's talk about this by ourselves later." There are closed-door sessions, secret talks. The two of us plan our diplomatic interventions at strategic planning meetings late at night over a glass of wine. Can our son really go see that movie? Who's going to tell my mother we're not coming for Christmas? Just like at high-level talks, if communication breaks down, we're sunk. If we start name-calling or foisting our own self-serving agendas, we're not going to get anywhere. One way that we have found to keep our little world under one roof, happy together, is to have family meetings. This is our opportunity to sit down together at a table and negotiate our treaties. Here's my daughter, Nora.
So it's really sort of like a normal conversation, only with an agenda.
We have a job chart that tells us who's supposed to help before and after dinner, who does garbage, recycling, laundry. This month, my son Henry is supposed to be in charge of cleaning the two bathrooms.
You can make the parallel to, I guess, like political treaties and stuff. I guess it has good intentions, but doesn't work the greatest.
After 16 years of household diplomacy, I recently learned a new lesson from my kids. Sometimes, as much as you might want to police your little world, it's better just to stay out. Here are my daughters, Lainey and Nora.
So we got really mad at each other, And then mom came along and was like, rah, rah, stop fighting. And we were like, no, let us handle our own problem.
We calmly and composedly turned to her and said, Mom, this is our problem, okay? Can't we just figure it out ourselves?
It almost killed me, but I let Nora and Lainey figure it out by themselves. My children are trying to teach me another lesson in diplomacy. After growing up in combative households, my husband and I believe the diplomatic approach is almost always better than letting tempers flare. But the kids have a different theory. Yelling works, sometimes.
Even yelling can help resolve things, even though adults, like, deny it. But I think it actually worked better than sitting down on the couch and having a sermon about respect.
Over 16 years together, our diplomatic crises have evolved from fights over wooden blocks to who controls the mouse when editing home movies on the computer. But the struggle for sound diplomatic relations will never change. It's the reality of daily life under one roof. It's not unlike the reality our world leaders know. Communication about schedules and agendas, respecting and sometimes questioning leadership, airing grievances, letting some fighting factions work things out on their own. Maybe before we send our country's diplomats off to the UN or to the latest global hotspot, we should ask them one very important question. How many kids have you raised? Diplomacy really does begin at home.
Nancy Olesen is the producer and host of Mombo, a radio and podcast resource for moms. She lives with her husband and three kids in South Minneapolis. You can learn more at mombo.org. You know, so far tonight on In the Loop, we've picked up insights about diplomacy at the international level, at school, at home. And as we face these diplomatic challenges, we would all love for our leaders to set the right example. Well, at the moment, they're giving it their best shot, aren't they? It's hard to miss the show of diplomacy now on display in the nation's capital, and here in Minnesota, for that matter. On both levels, the voters left a Republican executive with a Democratic legislature. Literally overnight, Republicans and Democrats went from years of name-calling and fear-mongering to a kind of political campfire sing-along. The camp counselors leading the chorus are President Bush and new Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
It is now our duty to put the elections behind us and work together with the Democrats and independents on the great issues facing this country. I told Congresswoman Pelosi that I look forward to working with her and her colleagues to find common ground in the next 2 years.
And we will do so, working together with the administration and the Republicans in Congress in partnership, not in partisanship.
It'll be difficult. It'll be difficult. Partisanship on Capitol Hill hasn't been this high for about almost 100 years.
Catherine Pearson says you would expect all this make nice talk after this election result. She's a political scientist at the University of Minnesota. Before they actually have to do anything, everyone wants to sound like they're ready to do the right thing.
They have incentives to make these promises and incentives to try, but in the context of polarized parties that don't see eye to eye a lot and a polarized electorate, I think it'll be hard. The fights have been quite bitter over the last 12 years.
Democrats, Pearson says, are unlikely to forget they have hardly been able to get a bill to the House floor since Republicans took control in 1994. In recent years, the verbal jabs have gotten deeply personal. Democrats implying the president isn't quite up to the job. Republicans suggesting Democrats like Pelosi don't really love the country. But what about that chummy meal the other day at the White House? Bush even served up some of Pelosi's favorite dishes.
Pasta and chocolate. I was raised on it. It was really lovely.
I'm sure they were both on their best behavior, but I've got to think there were a lot of issues they avoided, and it had to have been awkward.
Maybe there'll be more get-to-know-you dinners in the future, you think? Or is this just making nice at the beginning of this process?
I wouldn't hold your breath for any regular dinners or socializing. Again, they both have incentives to try, but they have a hard history, so it'll be tough.
Now, Bush and Pelosi are hardly the first couple to try to make amends with each other. Dave Decker would know.
Actually, it parallels all too closely situations that I've seen in my practice.
Decker is a psychotherapist who works with troubled couples and anger management. He says the fatal temptation in a crumbling relationship or a divided government is
power. And how is power handled? When one party or the other gains control, they use the power to deal with old grudges, old feuds, and so it's time to punish and get retribution.
For Democrats in Congress, that temptation could mean lots of investigations now that they control the committees. It could mean stalling anything that looks like it might add to the president's legacy. But still, Pelosi and Bush are saying they want to make up, work together. So I asked Dave Decker if a feuding couple came into the office and suddenly said they were willing to put it all behind them, shouldn't we give them the benefit of the doubt?
I actually don't hear many couples come in and say that. And it really is kind of a long and arduous process frequently to get couples to work on their relationship and to become collaborators, to become friends, to become confidants versus enemies and adversaries.
If you had, say, President Bush and Nancy Pelosi here on your couch, where would you even begin with them to try and smooth things over?
I don't think they'd come to my couch. I don't know that they'd come to anyone's couch.
Well, not quite. They can certainly come to ours.
George and Nancy, welcome to your first counseling session. Before we begin, I want you to know that by just being here, you are showing your commitment to make this relationship work. George, do you understand why Nancy made this appointment for the two of you to see me today?
You think I'm nuts? You think my sensibilities left me?
No, it's not that at all. Nancy thought that by talking through your problems with me, we can bring the two of you even closer together.
The oversight will be very important because then the truth would be revealed.
Thank you, Nancy. But let's try to use positive language. George, are you with us?
This isn't, as we said, this isn't my first rodeo.
Okay. George, can you remember some of the things Nancy has said recently? Things that have hurt you?
I must confess I cannot catalog for you in detail the different criticisms.
Well then, Nancy, do you remember what you might have said to George that
night? Oblivious. In denial. Dangerous.
Yes. George, how does that make you feel?
Are you bringing this up so everybody else gets kind of jealous?
Let's move on. George, can you remember some of the hurtful things you've said to Nancy?
That kind of question is the kind of thing that causes one to, you know, I really haven't, it's tough in a time of war.
I would say that it's the same old on the part of the president. He has no answer to the question.
Nancy, I think we need to talk for a moment about your attitude.
What about it?
Well, we need to keep it positive.
We have never heard a clear plan from this administration, and we did not hear one tonight.
No, I knew you'd probably try to get me to start negotiating with myself.
Okay, I'm not totally sure you're both really committed to doing this.
We're here about the future. That's where our priorities are.
Well, I am glad to hear that. George, do you think you can spend some time over the next week considering what we talked about today?
I'm trying to get the Indian deal done, the Vietnam deal done, and the budget's done. But I'll take a look at it.
Good. Nancy?
The president got the message, thank heavens. And I think it signals a new change, I hope.
Well, that's all for today. Good luck, you two, and God bless America.
Well, thank you to our stand-in therapist, NPR's own Greta Cunningham, and of course to George and Nancy for their gracious cooperation with that piece. Now, our house band tonight, the Smarts, got a pretty easy assignment for me this time around, isn't that right, Joe?
Yeah, when Jeff first came to me with what they had finally decided the theme was going to be for this month, he said, "Well, it's diplomacy." Very diplomatically, I said, "Well, that sounds like a great theme for a pop song. Maybe we can do it about, relationships and dating and things like that." And he said, "Well, we were sort of hoping you'd do it about, say the North Korean nuclear crisis." And I said, "Well, how about both?" So depending on how you want to think about this next song, it's either from the perspective of Kim Jong-il or Kevin Federline. Talk when we're alone. seems the more I do, less I can get through to you. Make you see things from my view. I could crawl back in my shell, or I could blow it all to hell. Got one card, but play it well. Sorry if it feels like hard sell. To be, get you just to notice me, can't be taken seriously, spare me your diplomacy, meet me in my DMZ, just the two of us for coffee. Well, it's my way, or it's your way, and there's no way in between, and that's why, and there's your side, and there's my side, no one's on. Isolated I become,
compliant. You're undone.
I may be the one the world's against.
The one who's working on a
Smarts are Morris Engel on drums, Jimmy Kennedy on keys, and Joe Weissman on bass. They were gracious enough to let me sit in on a little soprano sax there. You can find more of their music at thesmartsband.com. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. Our website is minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. And if you go there, you can find all kinds of wonderful ways to interact with us. We've got a blog going on. You can subscribe to the blog feed if you want. We are going to have a podcast coming up soon. And, of course, you can sign up to be a part of our Loop network, which is really the way we hope to grow this show and to create, you know, a kind of radio that really thrives on the audience that enjoys it, we hope anyway. North Korea, as we heard in a whatever kind of warped way we did in that particular song, is certainly one of the most prickly diplomatic problems facing the United States. It's now a nuclear country with long-range missile capability and a leader often described as unstable. We hear on the radio and read in the papers what U.S. pundits think, but in keeping with our theme tonight, we wanted to find a perspective a little closer to home. There are 1.2 million Korean Americans, including almost 15,000 here in Minnesota. As you might expect, they don't necessarily speak with one voice on the approach to North Korea. So with me now are Byung-Moon Kim, who has written widely on Asian and Korean issues and is a news analyst for Korean Quarterly. He also stages cultural events as the director of the Korean American Today and Tomorrow Center. Byung-Moon, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And next to him is Roy Kim, who retired in 1998 as an electrical engineer at 3M. He now owns a business in St. Paul, selling urban fashion and hair products. He's the current chairman of the Minnesota Korean Chamber of Commerce. Roy, thank you for joining us. Both Kims, I should say, are members of the same church congregation and friends going back many years. But of course, being friends doesn't mean they see completely eye to eye on the best course to take with North Korea, which is why we have them here with us tonight. Roy, maybe I'll start with you. Do you think that we ought to open up and engage more with North Korea and its leaders than we are right now?
Yes,
I definitely believe that. The reason we have to talk more is to understand each other. You have to communicate, you have to open your heart so that you understand the other side. So you cannot just judge people just unilaterally. So therefore, definitely, we have to talk more.
Byung Moon, I gather you think we need to take maybe a little bit harder line with them, maybe place more conditions on the relationship?
We are talking about living in peace. And when we are challenged by conventional weapons and atomic weapons, and then we can't live in peace. So in order to achieve peace among ourselves, United States and four other countries, in so-called Six Nations talk, should set a very clear goal so that North Koreans would share the wonderful ideals to live in peace together.
So just to sort of sum up for you, it's important to set conditions. We're not talking to them directly until they deal with the weapons. And things like, I don't know, the counterfeiting of U.S. currency is another one, right?
North Korea has been engaging in drug dealings, cigarette smuggling, and also counterfeiting the American currencies. And so that kind of practice should be stopped.
Roy, do you think that your situation, being separated from very close family still in North Korea, affects deeply the way you view that situation?
August 15, I visited North Korea to see my sisters, five sisters. It is very hard to live far apart with your, you know, beloved siblings. If I want to visit North Korea, then I have to go through third country because there is no any direct diplomatic between North and U.S.
Of course. Complicates matters greatly for you. The fact that we're not talking to them, we're not engaging with them, we don't have relations with them, keeps you apart from your family.
That's true.
Byung Moon, I suppose you have heard that argument. How do you respond?
The Koreans, whether they are relatives in North Korea or those without relatives, I very much sympathize with their conditions. And I would like them not to be hungry, and they would not live in fear, and they would express themselves. I would like to emphasize that North Korea has a very excellent option to make its country prosperous. South Korea normalized its relations, diplomatic relations with Japan in 1965. And Japan provided $200 million plus some loans to South Korea. And based on that compensation, South Korea has taken off from the dirt poor countries. You know, North Korea could do a lot of things for its people.
They have to make some moves. The ball is in their court. They could make some very simple changes, and we could establish those relations, but that has to be done.
Yes, and there it comes to that diplomacy.
But as Roy has said, the North Koreans don't seem especially willing to make those moves. That would seem to be a fine point, but it puts a pretty considerable gulf between the two of you. I want to ask, you have been friends for a while. Do your disagreements over details on the approach to North Korea ever get in the way of your friendship? Does this become a personal issue?
We talked about a lot of issues together, and so he has his own interpretation and I have mine. But we say that, well, we are thankful that we can talk about those issues and we can stay as friends because here in the United States we can speak without being in fear.
Roy?
Yeah. I believe we have to know the basic things, why North Korea has been isolated. I believe that's because of interest among the superpowers. They are not poor because of they are lazy. They are not poor because of they are stupid. Superpower trying to impose economic sanction. Suppressing, squeezing economically, I don't think there's a diplomacy way, you know.
Roy, thank you. Well, I'm sure this conversation could and will continue between the two of you for many years yet. Roy Kim and Byung Moon Kim, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Now, you're welcome to both. You're welcome to both stay seated, if you like. I'm going to broaden the conversation a little bit. And in fact, the pastor of your church is here in our audience. And I wanted to get a quick word with him, if I could. This is Jong Hyung Lee, who helped put me in touch with these two gentlemen. Pastor Lee, do you have to be careful about how you speak about these issues?
Yes.
what's the yes, okay, you know, maybe that's just how careful
even though
you have to
I
be.
Say good things, some people might be, you know, offended. So pastor is in the, you know, middle situation to, you know, to reconcile so many people. So it's a really diplomatic position, I think.
We're going to bring the lights up in the UBS forum, and I hope get our audience in on this conversation and spread it to a more personal level. I'm wondering, how many of you feel like diplomacy is given more short shrift lately? Feel like diplomacy's on the wane. This is a concept on the way out. Sure.
Well, it seems to me that it's part of the, I mean, specifically the American culture in the last few years, that discussion is a sign of weakness, that it's always a more powerful position to take a side, stubbornly stick to it, and if the other person presents even a logical argument against your side, to try to force their hand simply by intimidation. And I see that reflected in our foreign policy.
Thank you. Do you feel anybody like that trickles down into our own lives? Do we follow the course that our leaders set?
I think that we do. And at this particular time in our life, I think we have seen a societal acceptance of bullying. I think the bullying started in the White House. It goes into the classroom. We see it in our cars. I think we have taken the power that if we're big and we have money or we have position, we can force other people to do what we want them to do. So until we decide as a society to say, we don't do this here, it'll continue.
Now, I know that we have a number of folks in the audience who serve as community mediators. Community mediators, can you put your hands up? Oh, that was one of them right there we just heard from. I wonder if one of you can maybe relate for me, you know, an experience. First of all, what types of mediation do you do? But are you finding this in the folks that you work with in those situations?
My name's Tom. I'm in with community mediation as well. What I've noticed is people like to win. And they believe that they will win in every instance. The big question that you have to ask them has to help convince them that there's something bigger than either party alone will receive. They have to figure out that it's not about winning by themselves.
Do you believe that that ordinary people, such as ourselves, can do things that can benefit our international diplomacy? Are there actions that we can take to sort of spread our understanding at the personal level upwards? Yeah, right over here.
I think our story goes back to diplomacy in the traditional sense. There is a program in this area called Connect U.S. Russia, and it brings individual groups to this country, to the Twin Cities. Each of the individuals, instead of being in a hotel, lives with an American family. The diplomacy piece of it is that typically we start out with no language skills. The same case is true for our guests. You begin to have to negotiate that dialogue. And by the time this chemistry of living together, learning almost desperately to communicate, you begin to develop a deep friendship and a deep understanding. And they are friends, our family now in Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan or Moldova have gone back and understood that we are not our foreign policy, that we are not our military structure, that we are communities and families, that we carry values. But more importantly, we understand that our friends who are Muslim in Uzbek or who are Orthodox in Ukraine are humans with families and lives and structures.
Thank you. That sounds very much in harmony with, I think, what we're hoping to explore tonight, which is that there's, you know, diplomacy at any number of levels that we can exercise, and that maybe there's a connection among them all. I think our director, Alan, has a comment.
Yes, I'm Alan from St. Paul, originally from Brooklyn. But I just recently did a lighting design for a Chinese dance company locally here in St. Paul. And the artistic director was from and is from mainland China, and she speaks very little, if no English. So I had to work with the assistant stage manager, Xu Ling, who was my interpreter. And we had a great number with lots of fog at the beginning. And I lit it with blue and green. It was morning mist. It was gorgeous. Unfortunately, the artistic director did not like that. She wanted it bright. And I told Xu Ling, I said, you have to tell her that fog and bright just doesn't go together, and it would look ugly. So Xu Ling then decided to talk to her, and I'm listening, and I could hear her grunt, the artistic director, every so often. And Xu Ling turned to me and said, you got your way. You can keep it the way you have it. And I said, Xu Ling, what exactly did you tell her? And just straight face, she looked right at me and said, I told her you were too stupid to make changes on the cues. Well, now that was diplomacy.
In a way, well, Alan, unwittingly, you have taken us in the direction we go from here. Because it sounds like the translator decided that to be efficient, she would disregard her diplomacy with you. So we have a couple of stories coming up in a moment about people who decided that dispensing with diplomacy was the better course for them, and we'll hear what happened. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. You're listening to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Up until this point, we have generally assumed that diplomacy is more or less the best way to handle conflict. But diplomacy has its limits. Appeasement in the 1930s, for example, didn't stop Hitler from abusing his power, and negotiation didn't give the U.S. its freedom from the English. And in small ways every day, we all make the choice between diplomacy, confrontation, and backing down. Producer Sandon Totten spoke with people in our Public Insight Network about what happens when you decide to ditch diplomacy.
You don't expect a Methodist pastor to descend to name-calling, but that's what Mark Peacock did when he was trying to win support for a new bike path in his community. He realized he couldn't get another member of the Polk County Board to agree through negotiation.
So I zapped off a letter to the newspaper and basically said, you know, we're kind of being held hostage by a bunch of financial skinheads on the county board. Well, financial skinheads went over really...
He tried to rally support for his cause through outrage, and it worked.
So people stopped me in the hallway, patted me on the back, financial skinheads, you know. I got stopped outside the post office and congratulated. Boy, you really nailed it. Financial skinheads, you know.
Mark says he felt great. The bike path was slated for construction. But over time, something began to trouble him. As a member of the Polk County Board, it was inevitable he would have to deal with the same representative he insulted.
Eventually, you need to talk to people. I mean, when you tag people, when you demonize them, they're not much inclined to work with you. We've got problems we really need to solve. And so, you know, we need to be cooperating instead of zinging each other.
To mend fences, he publicly apologized. He says he learned a lesson in diplomacy he thinks our current administration should consider.
To label regimes as the axis of evil was the kind of a clever phrase I might have come up with, but in terms of the people whose behavior we would like to change, was counterproductive.
Mark ditched diplomacy and then regretted it. For Greta Anderson, it was the only way to get what she wanted. Greta is the daughter of a career diplomat who served all over Europe and Asia. She's a former international purchaser who now stays at home with her two sons. Greta has played nice and preserved relationships all her life. That is, until one of her sons needed her help.
I have two sons, Dirk and Brahm, and Brahm's the younger of the two, the one with the autism. So, and he loves to move garbage cans.
New garbage cans.
Can you roll the trash can to Mom and then put it back?
I got this.
Her youngest son was diagnosed as autistic when he was 2 years old. Greta read everything she could find on autism, and when she asked her family doctor for a special treatment for her son, he flat out refused.
It made me angry. It was that kind of, I'm the doctor, you know, this is what it is. After 2 years of doing a lot of research and living with the autism, the doctor basically just invalidated everything I knew.
She had argued with the doctor over various treatments in the past to no avail. He wouldn't listen. She had a choice, escalate and fight, give in, or disengage. She decided to find a new doctor.
You're coming up against a brick wall, and you try diplomatically to get around it, to get them to understand your point of view, and some of them just absolutely cannot see it.
Greta ditched diplomacy and got what she needed. But it's not a strategy that's open to everyone. Take Lisa Ragsdale. Her daily life is strewn with people who confront her.
I was just going to take a walk. This young black man is coming the other way, and he goes, "You're a guy, right?" I just started walking the other way. I just turned my head. No, I'm not a guy.
Lisa is a male-to-female transsexual. She underwent sexual surgery in 1996. While estimates of the number of transsexuals living in the U.S. are hard to come by, it's safe to say that it's rare. For Lisa, her male voice and female body can attract rude comments and trouble from people.
When they see or experience somebody who's radically different from them, especially like a transsexual type person, they're just offended. They're just like, ooh, get away from me, you know, you creep me out or something.
She says diplomacy got her nowhere with some people. This was especially true at her last job. Eventually, she had to leave to escape a demeaning boss.
I'd done all the diplomacy and courteousness I could, and nothing was working, so I said, fine, I don't care. I don't like the job, I don't like you, I don't want to be there. You know, just forget it.
Lisa is still unemployed. Ditching diplomacy clearly comes with a cost, whether it's losing relationships, losing your livelihood, or, for nations, losing security and even losing lives in war. Those costs are what keep people talking and governments negotiating, and why diplomacy is so ingrained in daily life. It's also why knowing when to ditch diplomacy is so hard and so important.
That was In the Loop's assistant producer, Sandon Totten.
My name is Rabbi Adam Stock-Spilker, rabbi of Mount Zion Temple in St. Paul. I would say that all of life is about relationship, and relationship is about diplomacy. And if all those relationships are successful, then not only do we see the other person in that relationship, we also see the eternal one in that relationship. In my view, that's where God is in the meeting of two people. And so therefore, diplomacy is about recognizing the holiness within relationships among all people. In Genesis, it says that each person is created in the image of God. I had a professor in rabbinical school who every day when he went on the subway looked at each person who was on the subway car and said, and to himself, made in the image of God. And he'd look at another person, made in the image of God. And that mantra, that way of intentionality about the way he related to other people, affected everything about who he was as a person. If you have those moments enough and you open yourself to those moments enough, then you can help people see each other as full subjects, not objects, not using each other. And that leads to people working together, to compromising, and what we call diplomacy.
Before we close tonight, as we have said, one of the big diplomatic events of recent months has been North Korea agreeing, in principle, to join six-party talks with the U.S. and other nations. Now, what brilliant act of diplomacy finally did the trick? Well, we won't say just how, but In the Loop has come upon a secret White House tape of the conversation that sealed the deal. And we are very proud to be able to share that with you now.
Mr. President, I understand Mrs. Johnson has cleared security.
All right. You know, I feel like we have to try this, Dick. I mean, nothing else seems to work trying to get through to the North Koreans.
Now, the folks at the State Department suggested we try one last strategy, some diplomatic technique out of Minnesota. Now, normally we don't listen to those yahoos over at the State Department.
Oh, we certainly don't listen to those people out in Minnesota, do
yeah.
we?
Well, desperate times call for desperate measures,
yes, of course,
Mr. President.
Yes.
Yep. Yep, send her in.
All right. Well, here goes nothing.
Oh, my gosh almighty, look at this place.
Oh, Mrs. Linda Johnson, I'd like you to meet the President of the United States.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, hello there, Mr. President. Yeah. It looks like you're holding up real well, you know, considering.
Mrs. Johnson, we have North Korean President Kim Jong-il on the line. Mm-hmm. I believe you've been briefed.
Oh, yeah, you betcha. Mm-hmm.
Now, as I give you the phone, remember, we are dealing with a very sensitive situation.
Hello, Mr. Kim. Are you there? It's Linda Johnson from up Fridley. How are you? How's your mistress doing? Say, Mr. Kim, I've been meaning to tell you. I just love what you've done with your hair. No, really, I do. You know, my Aunt Greta had a perm just like that, God rest her soul. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it was the same thing. It slims a chubby face right down. Say, Mr. Kim, I've been wondering, have you got that tuna hot dish we sent you?
No, I got it.
Oh, yeah, you're going to love it. It'll just warm you right up. Yeah. Okay, now here's what you got to do, Mr. Kim. You just take the pan and you nuke it for about a minute or so. Well, anywho, look, we sent a few hundred pans, so if you and your wives and generals have any left over, I don't know, maybe some of those 23 million people outside might want some. Now, Kim, you don't have to get snippy.
Oh, snippy.
You of all people should be in a good mood. After all, you had yourself quite a little nuclear test the other day. Bother me? Oh, heck no, I thought it was kind of cute. Well, you know, no one's ever had a nuclear test that small. Some people criticize, of course, but you know, to me, it was just downright precious. Well, you know, Kimmy, look, now, if you're interested, we're going to have a little potluck later this month. Now, it's no big whoop, just a few people from the neighborhood getting together. China's going to be there. You like China now, don't you? Sure you do. And Russia's coming by, going to bring a big pan of beef stroganoff. Kind of like a little party for six. And we're going to play some bingo.
Yeah.
You'll like that, Kim. You really will. And maybe, you know, we'll just sit down and we'll talk about how we can all get along a little better. Well, super. Now, don't you get into any trouble in the meantime. And these nice guys are going to work on the details. So bye-bye now, Kimmy.
So, the six-party talksy. He's going to come?
Oh, yeah, you betcha. It's just like talking to my Herb, you know. See, what you do is you slip your points in through the back door, and they'll never know what hit them.
Wow, that's really something. You know, Mrs. Johnson, I hear Iran is very nice this time of year.
Well, who knew that Minnesota nice could be so effective, huh? Thank you to Joe Weissman, David Jonas, and Susan Fuller for a little help with that sketch. I have to give a few thank yous to people who've helped make the show possible tonight. Molly Bloom, double thank you to her because I forgot to thank her last time. Sam Chu, Pastor Jonghyung Lee, Martha Vickery, Jackie Fuller, and the staff of Public Insight Journalism here at Minnesota Public Radio. Ambar Espinoza and Ilona Piotrowska helped make our live show possible this evening. Sam Keenan is our recording engineer. Josh Kubasta is the technical director here at the UBS Forum. Sandon Totten is our assistant producer. Michael Scholar is the executive producer of In the Loop. Remember, our next gathering is November 28th at the Bad Waitress in Minneapolis. Go to minnesotapublicradio.org/InTheLoop to keep up on the details with that and everything else going on with our show. Thank you very much. I'm Jeff Horwich. See you next month.